I am glad to see you this evening. If you don't have a handout that talks about Luke chapter 8, we have those here on this table. Last time we were, we finished up chapter 7 and we had gotten into chapter 8, in particular talking about the women followers of Jesus in Luke 8, 1 through 3, and then some of the parables and parabolic sayings about those who hear and who are true disciples in Luke chapter 8, verses 4 through 21. And if I remember correctly, when we ended, we were talking about how Jesus' mother and brothers come to him, but they're outside the crowd. And Jesus had left his house, and when he makes his statement, "Who is my mother and my who are my mother and my brothers? It's anyone who hears and follows me." That Jesus is not putting down his family. Rather, he is talking about those who are his family in the kingdom that he has brought. Not just his physical family, but those who will follow him spiritually, hear his words, hear his teachings, etc. And then that's where we left off. Next we come to a story that is in more than one of the Gospels, the healing of the Gerasene, or in some Gospels, it's Gadarene, the Gerasene or Gadarene demoniac, is right after Jesus calms a storm. Starting with Jesus calming the storm, I jumped ahead to the Gadarene or Gerasene demoniac. One day he got into a boat with his disciples and said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they put out, and while they were sailing, he fell asleep. A windstorm swept down on the lake, and the boat was filling with water, and they were in danger. They went to him and woke him up, shouting, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he woke up and rebuked the wind and the raging waves. They ceased, and there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" They were afraid and amazed and said to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Luke's version of this story is shorter than we find in other Gospels. His statement simply to the disciples who are scared to death is very simply, "Where is your faith?" Jesus has just seen the faith of others who have been shown to him. This is also an intro into stories about faith, the Gadarene demoniac, the woman who touches the fringe of Jesus' garment, and the synagogue leader, Jairus, whose daughter is dying and is dead by the time Jesus gets there. And all of these are activities of faith which Jesus will reward the Gerasene demoniac, the woman who touches the hem of his garment, and Jairus, as opposed to the disciples who have been with him so far, have seen what he has done, and yet their faith, what he's saying is, their faith is so small in comparison and contrast with all of these other people. A demoniac who's not in his right mind, he's in his left brain, no, he's not in his right mind. A woman, once again, this is Luke, a woman who is outcast but yet dares to come to Jesus and show faith. She doesn't even ask Jesus. She simply thinks, "If I can touch the hem of his garment, I can be healed." And then the religious leader, Jairus. Jairus is a Pharisee. Jairus takes a chance. He hasn't seen all the things Jesus has done. He's just heard about them. And yet here you'll have this religious leader that comes and takes a chance on being ostracized and showing faith in Jesus, whereas the disciples who have seen all this stuff show very little faith in Jesus. And so he's asking them, "Where is your faith?" This storm story shows Jesus' authority in the realm of the created order. It's also interesting to note, if you think back, where in the Bible? Where is the first place in the Bible? This also points to Jesus as Lord, Jesus as the Godhead. Where is the first place in the Bible that the storm is calmed? A little bit further back, Where is the first place in the Bible that the stormy waters are calmed? Genesis chapter 1. There was darkness upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of the Lord was moving over the face of the waters. And in the middle of that chaos, God says, "Let there be light," and there was light, and it was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God created good and order in the middle of the watery chaos. Jesus calms the watery chaos. It points to Jesus, not only Jesus' authority over the created order now, but in Luke's theology and in Luke's understanding, it also places Jesus, it points right back to Jesus being present in creation as part of the Godhead in Genesis chapter 1, the created order of things. So there's no question for Luke that Jesus, there is no question for Luke that Jesus is not only Lord, but Jesus is God. Jesus is God. And it emphasizes, too, that those who truly understand and do the Word are those who show faith. They show faith because they have faith. Faith is not something that you have and you tuck it inside and don't do anything. Like we said this morning, within Judaism, the two ideals of Judaism are to study and prepare, that's internal, and then to do something with it, that's external. Those who have faith will show faith, is what Luke is saying here, and what Jesus is saying to the disciples. Do you not recognize who I am? Where is your faith? You say you've got it. You've come to follow me. You're sure not showing it. You're sure not proving it. And so we've throughout Luke especially, there's this constant, you have to do, you have to do. But then again, in Matthew, that's also in the Sermon on the Mount. Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom, but those who do the will of my Father who sent me. Those who have faith will show faith. And such a faith which shows itself, takes Jesus and His power more seriously, should be than the storms of life, typo, more seriously than the storms of life. The desert times, the storms of life can't overcome if you show faith. If we show faith. And that's really what this, how Luke views this, and they're amazed. They say, "Wait a minute, who is this?" Now they've followed him around, they've seen all the stuff he's done, they've heard his teachings, and now he commands the created order. I guess, in some sense, the disciples must have thought, well, Jesus must just have some power over small things. But the storms are something that are totally out of control, and they're on the Sea of Galilee, large lake. The storms, not only then, but even today, that roll across the Sea of Galilee are known to be extremely violent. And here Jesus, with a word, calms the storm. Well, if Jesus, with a word, can calm the created order, which is out of their control, then Jesus says, "Where's your faith?" And they say, "Well, yeah, this guy does more than we think." So we've got Jesus' power over the created order and His link with God and creation. The next story, the Gerasene or Gadarene demoniac, shows Jesus' power once again over the realm of the invisible, the realm of the demonic, those powers and principalities that Paul talks about later, that he is over the invisible realm. You have to remember that in the ancient world and even within Judaism, as much as they talked about God and God having the power and God having the control, they were constantly afraid of what lurks in the dark out there. They were constantly afraid of evil forces that were out there. We talked the other day in Leviticus chapter 16 at our Wednesday morning Bible study, the establishment of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The scapegoat was sent out into the wilderness with the sins of the people on it to evil, known as Azazel. Because evil is out there somewhere. And it scared them to death. You didn't want to be caught in the wilderness at night, in the dark, because that's when evil especially came around. So here Jesus, those invisible powers, those things that go bump in the night, from ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night. Dear Lord, preserve us. That's kind of how they felt about those things. And here we find Jesus showing his power over the realm of the invisible, the realm of the other powers that are out there. Then they arrived at the country of the Gerasenes, or Gadarenes, or sometimes it's Gergesenes, all the same particular area, which is opposite Galilee. As he stepped out on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. Now, think about this scene. This guy's not even, he's not even tied up out in the yard like a pit bull. He lives in the graveyard. He lives among the tombs. He's continuously unclean. And he's not just physically unclean. He is spiritually unhinged and unclean. Now, the region of the Gerasenes or Gadarenes is the only specific mention of a Gentile area because of the pig herds. We know this is not a Jewish area. And we do know from other archaeological finds that there were a lot of Gentiles, a lot of Greeks, transplanted Greeks and others that lived in this area. But the fact that there are pig farms here and pig herds here says it's not a predominantly Jewish area, because they wouldn't have pigs out there. It makes them unclean. And it also hints at the mission that early on, this continued hint by Luke, who is a Gentile, remember, that the mission of Jesus is not just to the Jews. Jesus is born into Judaism, yes. Jesus is born of, his parents that raised him are Jewish. Jesus is raised in the synagogue. Jesus is raised in the temple. Jesus is raised knowing the law. Everything about Judaism, and yet Jesus' mission, while it starts out to Jews, very quickly extends to everyone. Very quickly extends to everyone. This man, as being living in the tombs, is also regarded, as far as anybody's concerned, his family or anyone else, he's dead to them. I mean, he doesn't even live among his family at home. He doesn't live out in the yard. He doesn't live in a back room. He lives in the tombs at the local graveyard. I mean, if all of a sudden somebody said, well, Al's taken up out here in Rose Hill Cemetery, and he's running around all the time and hooting and hollering to Moon and everybody else. Not too many people want to go around Al, would they? He puts his head on one of those graves out there, on a gravestone for his pillow and all that kind of stuff. Of course, these days they'd have somebody come out with tasers and everything else and try and get him. But back then, no. Right. After everybody takes it, puts it on Facebook. This is our commissioner. But after a while, people would leave Al alone. And if Al did leave the tomb, start walking the graveyard, start walking up down the streets, people would probably cross to the other side of the road or turn around and go the other way, right? So basically, Al would be as if he were dead if he were like this guy. So this guy, even to his family, is like he is dead. He prefers the company of the dead. They don't argue. They don't talk back to him. He can talk all he wants to, tell them what he wants to. Well, in his mind, they might talk back, but, that's why, that's like, what's the cemetery? Oh, the cemetery in downtown Greenville. Over near the Bilo Center? Yeah, thank you, Springwood. And they built all those, they built those condos overlooking the graveyard. And you think, why in the world would you want to live? You don't have to worry about the neighbors being noisy. They're not going to crank up the music in the middle of the night. And if they are noisy, you better be heading the other way. But this man, it's interesting, the man comes out to meet him. The demon comes out for a confrontation, but some people think that there was something within the man that was still there that wanted to have this confrontation. For a long time, he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house but in the tombs. So not only is he unclean for that, but he's shameful. His own family wants to disown him because he doesn't wear any clothes, and he runs around among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" See, even the demons recognize who he is. Religious leaders generally don't. The disciples still aren't convinced. But here, even the demons recognize who he is. "I beg you, do not torment me." You know, the demon wonders what he, the demon, has to do with Jesus and what Jesus has to do with him. Actually, the Greek order here is, "What have I to do with you? Why should you even be around me?" Because I'm a demon, or I'm demon-possessed. "For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wild." There is this emphasis that Jesus, just being in the presence of Jesus, is tormenting to the demonic. Because Jesus is what? As I say here, Jesus is, as the text states, Son of the Most High God. He is Messiah. The man's been chained up. He's been tied up. It says chains and shackles. Chains were chains. Shackles were heavy leather bindings. He broke them both, which caused injury to him, too. So the man is tormented by his fetters and by his chains. And now this man who has been chained up is set free by Jesus. As I said here, he was dead, and now he is alive once again. Which also hints at Jesus' own death and resurrection. He was dead, now he's alive. Think of the parable that Jesus tells later about the prodigal son and his brother. And the father says, "This my son was dead, and now he is alive." So Jesus comes to give life, not death. Jesus comes to overcome death with life. And so Jesus says, "What is your name?" He already knew. And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. A Roman legion, and it's probably not, but for emphasis here, it's probably not this many, but there were several. Anybody know how many were in a Roman legion?
5,000.
Yeah. Five, sometimes six, but generally the average was 5,000 soldiers in a Roman legion. Now, I don't think there were 5,000 demons in this man, but the use of the word legion speaks to multiple problems that this guy has. All kinds of demons. Those demons could have been spiritual demons, but they could have also included emotional demons. They could have included physical demons. You know, there are all kinds of things that people refer sometimes to problems that we have as, well, that's so-and-so's demon. Jesus is here to overcome any and all. So the use of the word legion here means that Jesus isn't here just to heal the physical. Jesus isn't here just to overcome the storm. Jesus has the authority to overcome as many demons as we have, as many problems as we have, as many things that might go wrong in life as we can encounter. With the proper faith in Jesus and action on that faith, Jesus can and will heal. Jesus can and will heal. And they begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. It's interesting, I think, here that the bottomless pit, which was seen as the abyss, a prison for God's enemies, they don't want to go back in there. And what's really interesting is that Jesus, I think this is kind of interesting. It seems that Jesus is actually compassionate even toward the demons. Instead of sending them all the way back to the pits of hell where they don't want to go and they beg him not to, he sends them into the pigs, and the pigs run off and die over the cliff and die. That was seen by them as far better than going back into the abyss and suffering there. Jesus shows compassion even for the demons because they are begging and they are pleading. If Jesus would show such compassion to them, then why would Jesus not show us even more compassion and more grace? And so they beg him, don't send us into the abyss. Now on the hillside was a large herd of pigs feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Notice, the demons can't do anything without Jesus' permission. They can't leave this guy and go into the pigs unless Jesus permits it. Jesus' permission shows even more control over the realm of the invisible and the demonic. And if Jesus has that kind of control over that area, all we got to do is give him permission for any demon we've got, anything that we've got going on in us. And Jesus can and will. But notice, Jesus gives them permission. They can't do anything. They can't overcome without Jesus' presence and permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down a steep bank into the lake, and they were drowned. So Jesus has this strong authority, and when the herd drowns, the implication is that the demons die as well. Okay? Demons don't just go in people. But they go into the pigs here. Now, when the swineherd saw what had happened, sorry, I know it surprised you, but every time I read the word swineherds, I think about the song in "You'll Never Watch This Movie Again the Same Way." Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to ruin it for you now, at least this part. And the Sound of Music, when they sing about the lonely goat herd, I think about the swine herd and the old lady, oodle-loo. A lonely goat herd. They have little puppets. So next time you watch that, think about goat herd and think about them singing for the swine herds that just lost their swine. But sorry. But the herders run off. They're scared. The swine herders are scared. Yes, they complain about what happens, but the primary reason they run away, notice, they don't confront Jesus. They see what happens, and they turn, and they're gone. Fast as they can go away to tell other folks what just happened. Because they're scared. They're afraid of Jesus. But instead of being afraid, when the people come out, they find out Jesus is not someone to fear. Jesus offers healing. When the crowds come from the surrounding area, the people came out to see what had happened because they knew about this man. They heard this story and they thought, And when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. He's taking notes left-handed. No, in his right mind. And then they were afraid. They thought, wait a minute, we've been afraid of this guy out here. Now all of a sudden, this guy makes him better? Well, we need to be afraid of this fellow. Give him a wide berth. He's sitting at the feet of Jesus. He is ready to be instructed by Jesus and about Jesus. To be in the right mind is to be open to Jesus' message. But Jesus can also put us in our right mind if we will let Him. Key, if we will let Him. He's sitting there at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And then the former demoniac, those who had seen it told him how the one who had been possessed by the demons had now been healed. Remember, healing and salvation go hand in hand in the Gospel of Luke with Jesus. Then all the people of the surrounding country, the Gerasenes, asked Jesus to leave them, for they were seized with great fear, so he got into the boat and returned. But notice, the man from whom the demons had gone begged that he could go with him, but Jesus sent him away saying, return to your home and do what? Declare how much God has done for you. He was a missionary. Although some people would say, that's a good point, Jerry. Some people would say, you got Andrew going for Peter and you got Philip going for Nathaniel, but this is that first Gentile missionary, because this kid's a Gentile. He's not a Jew. He's living there in that country among the pigs and among the dead. He's a Gentile. But you're right, Jerry. Jesus doesn't say, okay, go home and relax and sit back. You got it made now. Jesus doesn't even say, don't go and sin anymore, because Jesus knows what has happened to this man. Jesus says, go and declare how much God has done for you. But notice where he told him to go first. Where did he tell him? Yeah. Go home. Go to your own family first. Tell your own family first. And then share it. And what did he do? He said, oh, no, nobody's going to believe me or everybody's going to be afraid of me. The text says, so he went away proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. The former demoniac, the one who was an enemy of Jesus, who was an enemy of God, ends up being a missionary force as he goes and tells. Tells everybody on his way home, tells the folks in his home, and then the text says he went throughout the city telling people what had been done. So once again, to have faith in Jesus means to show faith in Jesus. To have healing from Jesus means to tell people about that healing from Jesus. And Luke is very, very much aware of that. So we've got Jesus' power over the created order, calming the storm. We've got Jesus' continued power being shown over the demonic and the invisible forces. And now we've got, once again, another area, Jesus' power over physical illness and death. And this story really kind of has an interlude in the middle of it. Now, when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. Now, that doesn't mean when Jesus returned to the Gerasenes. That's when Jesus went back across the lake. Wasn't on the Sabbath, so it might have been Sunday. He was out on the lake. No. Jesus and the disciples, this takes place, they go back across the Sea of Galilee. And when he gets home, this would have been in the area of Capernaum again, which is kind of his base of operations. He gets there. There are people waiting. The word has spread already, all the way around the lake. Just then, there came a man named Jairus, a leader of the synagogue. He fell at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years old who was dying. Said a while ago, as I wrote here, Jairus is a leader in the synagogue. Jairus is showing faith in what Jesus can do, and Jairus is imperiling himself. He's imperiling his position in the synagogue, and he's actually on the edge of committing blasphemy, which could get him, if the Romans weren't occupying him, could get him stoned to death. But it'd certainly get him kicked out of the synagogue. He doesn't think about his position, rather he thinks about his family and what God can do through Jesus. It's also interesting that Luke includes the line, this is Jairus' only daughter and she's 12 years old, which means she's of marriageable age. It's the only child Jairus has. If she dies, Jairus' lineage ends. If she dies, there's no hope for any future children out of Jairus' line. If she dies, that is seen as a curse from God because he has no descendants, male or female, if she dies. All possibility that Jairus' family will continue ends. You know, people used to put a lot more emphasis on that than a lot of folks do these days, but I've thought a few times. My brother Phil and his wife have no children. My brother Mark and his wife have one daughter who has daughters. But they have one daughter. I have two sons that carry on the Hearn name from my lineage. My father's gone. In some ways, Stephen and Lynn have a daughter. If they don't have a son, David and Kristen, of course, David and Kristen only been married 2.5 years, but David and Kristen have no children yet. If they don't have a son, my son David is the last one to bear that name out of our family, because my father's cousins who are named Hearn, it's down to where their children either don't have children or they've got daughters. Something to think about sometimes. I know y'all probably never think about that, but every now and then I think about it, you know. And that's all the more reason that I've told my sons they need to be careful about what they do to the name. But Jairus' family will cease to exist if this daughter dies. Because also Jairus, at this point, by Luke saying this way, it's also seen as an indication, and many scholars say it's an indication, that Jairus and his wife are too old to have any more children. For whatever reason, they've got one. And that's it. And so Jesus immediately starts through the crowd. Well, you know what happens. The crowd's all pressing in on him. The disciples are pushing. It's as bad as one of these rock concerts where they got people, you know, the rock singer you see on the news, and they're trying to make their way through. Or I guess Schwarzenegger trying to make his way to the courthouse, and you can't get, everybody's trying to touch people and that kind of thing. It's interrupted by a woman's faith, and she tries to hide it. Notice this woman has faith in him, but she doesn't want to see anybody, or she doesn't want anybody else to notice, which really kind of makes me wonder sometimes, and I've started to do a sermon on this passage, and I may someday, and you already get a head start if I do, is this woman is trying to hide it, but Jesus calls her out. You know, a couple of years ago, I preached in camouflage, and you know, talk about whether you could really have a camouflage faith or not. So, you know, we're really not, if it's true faith, we can't camouflage it. This woman tried to hide it. Jesus called her out, basically to say, if you really have, you can't hide it. It's not meant to be hidden. It's not meant to be hidden. As he went, the crowds pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. And though she had spent all she had on physicians, no one could cure. Obviously, she didn't have good insurance either. But, I mean, she spent all of her living on doctors trying to get over this. 12 years. I find it interesting that Jairus' daughter is 12 years old and this has been going on with this woman for 12 years. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his clothes, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. She touches the fringe of his garment. Probably, you know, we think, oh, she touched him down here. It's probably the prayer shawl he's got on. I mean, somebody would notice this woman bending over like this following Jesus' skirts or his robe. Crowds pushing, pushing, pushing. All these people are pushing. People are touching Jesus. Nothing's happening. And this woman reaches out, touches the fringe on his shawl. Now, give me a break. You're going to feel somebody just barely touch the... You're going to feel somebody... You got an overcoat on in the middle of the winter and somebody just comes by and barely touches it. You think you're going to feel it? Especially if you're in the middle of a crowd. How can you distinguish? It shows Jesus' power of understanding as well as Jesus' authority. She just barely touches the fringe of his garment, his prayer shawl, which he's got on, wrapped around him, because no good Jewish male would be without that going through like this, and especially not a teacher. And Jesus immediately stops and says, okay, who did that? Did what? Who touched me? And everybody, wasn't me, this woman's doing like this back in the crowd, you know, backing up behind all these big, strong men. And Peter said, Master, what do you mean who touched you? Everybody's been pushing in. The crowds are around you. The crowds have pressed in on you. How can you tell? What's also really interesting to note is that this touch by a woman would have done something else, technically. According to Jewish custom and Jewish law, it was an affront. She was unclean with the flow of blood, and she touched him, and it would have made Jesus unclean. But she touched Jesus, and that little bit of faith and the hemorrhage stopped. No flow of blood any longer. And on the power to heal, Jesus simply says, "Someone touched me, for I noticed the power had gone out from me." Peter is incredulous. Jesus feels power leave, but notice he doesn't identify the woman. He knows who did it. If he's got that kind of authority and that kind of insight, he could have turned around and said, "Okay, you come out here now." But he didn't. Jesus left the decision to come forth and to be honest up to the confession he left up to the woman. He knew who had done it. But once again, the ball's in her court. Are you going to confess or not? I'm not so sure, had she backed away and not confessed, that she would have stayed healed. Don't know. She might have. But I kind of halfway suspicion that the reason her healing is complete and Jesus tells her to go in peace is because at that point she walked right out of the crowd and declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him. She just didn't say, "Well, yeah, I'm the one that touched you." The text says that she came out, came forward, not hiding her disease. She says, when the woman saw she could not remain hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. She didn't keep it a secret. She didn't keep what she had done wrong a secret. Open confession. Open confession. She didn't say, "Well, I did it. Sorry. You want me to wash your robe or your shawl?" She said, "I had this hemorrhage. I'm unclean, and I did it. And now I've been healed." She shows faith. Faith that issues forth with confidence, and Jesus looks at her and says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." She has been saved. That's what it means. Your faith has made you well. She has been saved from this disease and from this uncleanness. She's now clean. Notice Jesus didn't say, "Now go and do what the law says and make all these sacrifices for 7 days and all this kind of stuff." Jesus says, "You're clean. You're healed. Go in peace." Wouldn't have been peace for her to go and have to do all the sacrifices, right? And go show herself to the priest every day. Or after 7 days have the priest come in. Book of Leviticus. Jesus said, "You can have peace now. You're healed." Jesus brings peace immediately. Not, "Well, you know, wait a while and it'll happen. It'll come to you." Why? Because of her faith. Then he goes on with Jairus. Notice he doesn't stop. He doesn't forget Jairus. Jesus can multitask. While he was still speaking, someone came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter's dead. Do not trouble the teacher any longer." Somebody comes and says, "She's dead. We've checked it out. Tell him he can go on back. There's no need for him to come." When Jesus heard this, he replied, "Do not fear. Only believe, and she will be saved." Only believe. Now, he doesn't mean say, "Well, I think I believe." Only believe means really believe in your heart. And they were all weeping when they got there. He didn't allow anyone to enter when he got to the house except Peter, John, James, and the father and the mother. Everybody's crying, wailing for her, but he said, "Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing she was dead. And so they go inside. Jesus challenges the faith of the people that are assembled. And they go inside, and Jesus takes her by the hand and cries out, "Child, or little girl, arise." It would have been something like, in the other Gospels, it was Talitha Kumi. "Little girl, get up." It's not Talitha in the Gospel of Luke. It's Tekna, which is little child or little girl. "Arise, get up." He takes her hand, instructs her to arise, and the spirit, that is the life force that had left her, returns, and once again, Jesus is Lord over life and death. Her spirit returned, and she got up at once. They believe spirit left as soon as death happened. Sometimes the spirit would hang around for up to 3 days out in the tombs, so you didn't go out to the graveyard when somebody had died for 3 days. But once again, Jesus proves He is Lord over life and death, and He overcomes death. This, once again, is seen by many as simply a precursor, another one of those statements about what will happen with Jesus. And then He directs them to give her something to eat. He's restored her physical life. He's restored her soul. So give her something to eat. And her parents were astounded, but He ordered them to tell no one what had happened. Don't tell anybody. Up too late. And everybody outside, she's dead, she's dead, she's dead. What was Jesus saying? Jesus was trying to tell the parents and Peter, James, and John, first of all, you have to show your faith. Don't think there's some magical formula that you can hang on to and it's going to always work. Just because you say you believe doesn't necessarily mean it's going to take place. It's going to happen. You have to show that faith. And secondly, we've talked about this before, this whole messianic secret motif, why Jesus will do something like this or heal somebody and say, don't tell anybody, is because Jesus doesn't want to just be known as another miracle worker, and at the same time, He also doesn't want somebody to think, well, we've got this magical formula, abracadabra, hocus pocus, all that kind of stuff. Because we have mentioned before, out of the Gospel of Mark, this story, Jesus says, Talitha kumi, and the little girl gets up. And then in the book of Acts, at Tabitha's house, Peter is left with this dead woman. She's a Christian, she's a believer, she's done all this stuff for all these people, and she dies. Her name's Dorcas, also known as Tabitha. And so they take him in and say, she's died. Look at all this stuff she did. We really are so sad now. We're going to shut the door and leave you in here and you do something. And Peter's in there with that dead woman thinking, what in the world? And he starts praying to God, and all of a sudden, in the back of his mind, this incident comes, and the text says, and so Peter, when he was praying to God, leaned over to the woman and took her by the hand and said, Tabitha kumi. Talitha kumi, little girl, get up. Tabitha kumi, Tabitha, get up. And the woman sat up. Jesus didn't want just anybody going around doing that kind of stuff and thinking that, oh, hey, we've got this magical formula and we can heal all these folks and pass the chicken buckets around, collect money and heal you through the TV screen and all that kind of stuff. But it shows Jesus' power over all the realms of existence. Jesus' power over the created order, Jesus' power over physical illness, Jesus' power over the invisible powers, Jesus' power over death.
So that yes. was an instance where St. Peter raised somebody from the dead.
Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9.
Is there any other documentation that Peter raised anybody else from the dead?
There's another passage, and right now it escapes me. It flashed across the front of my brain. Now I think it went out the back door. But where Peter and Silas are together, and they raise somebody, and they say, "Oh, no, no." But this particular instance in Acts, I'll give you a specific reference in a moment. And choir can go on choir rehearsal. I'm over. I know. Starting in Acts chapter 9, verse 36, through the end of the chapter, verse 43. But in verse 40, Peter put all of them outside. He knelt down and he prayed. And he finally turned to the body and said, Tabitha, get up. And she opened her eyes, and seeing Peter, she sat up. He gave her his hand and helped her up. Then calling the saints and widows, he showed her to be alive. This became known throughout Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. Meanwhile, he stayed in Joppa for some time with a certain Simon, a tanner. And so here we've got that whole sense, though, that in Jesus' name, all kinds of things can be accomplished if it is truly shown, the faith is truly shown in Jesus' name. Peter doesn't take credit for that. And in other instances, the disciples don't take the credit for it. people bow down to him and say, oh, you guys must be gods. And he said, no, we're just men, just like you are. But let me tell you about somebody who is God. Thank you all. I know some of you have been watching the sky, especially after my weather report from my wife about quarter-size hail and downpours of rain. But next Sunday, Vacation Bible School. And Sunday night, if you want to come up there at 6, and then if you want to go to the youth, or you can come over and have a, you can come over and sing, or just hang out and talk, and then have ice cream. The 19th is Father's Day, and of course, we will not have evening service on Father's Day. But thank you. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.